Welcome to Holistic Matters Podcast. I'm John Trope, your host, and today we have an opportunity to meet and talk with Nicole Magrida. Nicole is a licensed dietitian, a clinical nutritionist, and a recent author of a new book. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us this morning. And so, we're excited about the new insights on the book that you have, which really is focusing on, using a family approach into establishing better and improved nutrition practices and habits. But is that a fair assessment? How would you describe the book to begin with?
Yes, I wrote the book really to empower parents. I did a lot of research over the last 5 years, and I recognized that, there are a lot of things that we as parents need to know in how to raise, nourished children in this day and age. There's just been a lot of changes in the last 30 to 40 years in my lifetime, and I think a lot of these changes can be addressed with some of, our lifestyle habits, and I think that's really what drove me to write it.
So the title of the book, by the way, is Nourish Your Tribe, and just by what the name denotes, it's really kind of it takes a village. I mean, is that how you look at
it? Absolutely does. Yeah. Yes.
How do you shift nutrition practices? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not just within our own nuclear families. I think it takes a community. And this is why I think it's important that we educate not just our own families and our friends. It takes, to be schools involved and our churches and our community members. And I think if we're all on the same page and we all sort of operate from this with this information at hand, then we all can support each other in this mission. And that's really what it's going to take. I think it's not just one person making a change in their house. It's collectively, imagine if the world was reversed, and instead of, offering our children, I always use this example, but when I go to soccer games with my kids, the knee-jerk reaction of parents is to give them Capri Suns and cupcakes after every game. But imagine if the world was very different when that was shunned upon, and instead we were only thinking in terms of, their health and nourishment and how we're going to raise optimally nourished children. So there just needs to be a shift in that perception. But if we collectively have this group think and we approach health from this angle, I think we all benefit and we do it together. And we all don't have to know everything, but we all can gain insights from each other in supporting each other in that mission.
Yeah, right. So tell us a little bit of how you got to this point in your journey in nutrition and healthcare. You have an undergraduate degree in medical nutrition therapy, and then that led to all of your clinical nutrition experiences. But how did you get interested in nutrition? Mm-hmm. When did that start in your own life?
I think I started, I was always a nature kid when I was young. I always had my hands in the dirt. I was always interested in gardening, and I think I just had sort of this intuitive interest in, how food and nutrients affect our well-being. And I think as a child, I was also, unfortunately, I had a lot of loved ones with various disease conditions. My father being one of them, he developed Alzheimer's disease at a very, very young age. And I think at that point, I looked at, that disease as well as many other chronic conditions. And I thought, there has to be a lifestyle component to this. Sure enough, as I went to college, and actually went to college on a business scholarship, and I thought I wanted to go into business, but I had such a strong interest in science and nutrition that quickly switched it. And ever since that day, and when I, after I graduated college, I was at University of Virginia, and was just exposed to, that was one of the greatest times of my life as far as nutrition education, because I was exposed to just all facets of health from that standpoint, and got really excited about it. And ever since that day, or ever since that time period in my life, I've just had my head deep in the books and wanted to learn as much as I can about all these topics. So,
right. So how have you made that link from, a lot of your early training experience, I think, was in classic clinical nutrition, right? Institution-based.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really great. That's really a great training ground and great insights. tends to be a little bit more technical than, say, the average person on the street, right? But it's important insights. Mm-hmm. How do you make that transition on that detailed into more practical issues with, you know, parents and kids and other people in the community?
Again, I think in reading, you know, I think there's a lot more to going beyond even nutrition. I think, you know, these lifestyle factors, you know, are stress. And because stress, I think, you know, getting back to my father, when I saw this as a young child, I always thought that stress and nutrition were two of his biggest issues. And I think, again, these are lifestyle issues that if we don't get a handle on them, they take over us. And I think I witnessed that firsthand. And I think I've just always had that innate wisdom about how we should approach health. And I think when I was really young, I was introduced to Dr. Ender Weil, and I think he really opened my eyes up to a lot of, you know, lifestyle medicine from that standpoint and how we can approach health in just a very, very different light than what I learned in the hospital setting.
Right. You know, before we start talking about, you know, things like an integrative medicine and holistic health, maybe we could spend a little bit of time on, you know, taking a look at the last, you know, 30 or 40 years of what's mm-hmm. taking place in our society in nutrition practices and changes in food processing, food companies, lower quality foods mm-hmm. that I think inadvertently have contributed to a decline of better nutrition to keep people healthy. But what's your perspective on like what's happened in the last 30 years that contributes to this high incidence and prevalence of chronic diseases?
Yeah, a lot, a lot. And that's the crazy thing, because 30 years is not a really long time. And I, you know, in terms of health and healthcare, and but if you just look at, you know, like you were saying, if you look at how we grow food and harvest it and process it and purchase it and prepare and how the food is marketed to us, there's been a tremendous amount of change. And I just think in our world today, it's just simply not enough to tell people to just change your diet or just eat healthy. I think we truly need to understand how we fit into a society that truly does everything in its power to encourage us to consume, you know, vast quantities of prepared foods that harm us, frankly, and as well as expose us to, you know, things like environmental toxins that are untested that clearly have a really strong influence on our health outcomes. I think maybe a good place to start is talking about, you know, how, you know, what's changed in the last 30 years as far as our disease risk, you know, or conditions. You know, chronic conditions are accounting for 75% of our healthcare costs, and one in every two Americans have at least one chronic condition. And I think we hear a lot about obesity ad nauseum. I think you probably have to be living under a rock if you haven't heard about our obesity epidemic, you know, with one in five children that are now obese and one in three adults. But it's the rate of increase of all of these chronic conditions that's truly alarming to me, you know, from, you know, obesity has doubled and tripled since the 1980s. And even diabetes, you know, when I worked in outpatient clinics in the 90s, you know, I rarely saw type 2 diabetes in kids. But today, I actually run a clinic with a partner of mine 2 days a month for just kids with metabolic syndrome that have either prediabetes or diabetes and high cholesterol panels, high triglycerides, and obesity. So I think, you know, there's just been such a tremendous shift in just this short period of time. I mean, it's type 2 diabetes is increasing kids by 30% between 2001 and 2009. That's just an enormous change. And you can look at a lot of other chronic diseases, and they have that same pattern. Like food allergies have increased 50% between 1997 and 2011. So one in 13 kids has food allergies, and it averages about two kids per classroom. And I know that's true in my kid's school every single year. And I don't remember that when I was a kid. But ADHD is another one. It's increased 42% in, I think it was between 2003 and 2011. One in every 11 children have ADHD, but we can do this with a lot of other conditions. And these chronic conditions, especially in childhood, are increasing, like autism and asthma and constipation and eczema and migraines and irritable bowel. The list goes on and on. But I think what we have to ask us is what's happened to cause such a huge shift in disease in this country. And I think we can start by looking at things like industrial farming and the food industry. And even if you look at what's changed since the 1980s to today, there's been enormous changes in these sectors, as well as the changes that have occurred, like in the family unit. You know, we have now dual working parents, and that's created an enormous shift in how we consume food. You know, we eat 50% of our food is now eaten outside the home. And on top of that, our marketing to children, who are now much more autonomous in their decision-making power at home, they're now being marketed to at nauseam, and that's due to some laws that changed in the 80s. And then, you know, lastly, I'd say we have, you know, enormous amount of environmental toxin exposure that makes it really difficult and challenging, I think, when we, in eating and becoming, you know, the healthiest versions of ourselves. I think epigenetics has taught us that we have this push-pull relationship with food and chemicals that we're being exposed to. So I think that's a really, really big one.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you look back at some of the recommendations, like in the late 60s and early 70s, right? And then the food pyramid got updated to kind of a change hierarchy in the, I think, early 90s. And then My Plate came on board in the early 2000s. And then there's an adjustment to My Plate. And so the recommendations seem to have shifted, where early, you know, in that series of events, it was all about calories and macronutrients. And today, more and more, we seem to be talking about the more important things. So not only calories and macronutrients, but also micronutrients and phytonutrients. But has that change kind of contributed to an improvement and a better basis for better education? Or how have the recommendations that you know, we've seen over that period of time helped or hurt us?
I'm not a huge fan of the USDA recommendations, simply because they're influenced so much by industry. This is my bias, but I never put a lot of faith into those recommendations. However, they do provide a good general structure, general guidelines. But, like, you know, what you were saying about the shift towards concentrating on micronutrients and phytochemicals, I think what's most important is, you know, quality nutrients and nutrient density. I think that's really where it's much more important. Calories, really, in my opinion, should never be the main focus. I think if you teach people how to eat and the right foods to eat, I think the rest really takes care of itself. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I, you know, as far as a, you know, following a specific food guide pyramid, you know, yes, I think there have definitely been improvements in it over the years, but I would still make improvements from the existing one that's true today.
Yeah. You have an interesting observation on, like, when you were growing up, you know, the incidence was rare to see so many kids with, say, type 2 diabetes or being overweight, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
What contributed to that? What was the root cause of that? In part, I think it probably had to do with the recommendation for higher consumption of poor quality carbohydrates that led to what I like to call, with my friends at the Joslin Institute in Boston, carbohydrate intolerance. And probably most Americans all suffer from that. But there had to have been a contribution because we're eating too many carbs. And probably, what do you think, in the mid to late 90s?
Well, we're eating too many. We're eating too many of the wrong carbs, right?
Yeah,
carbs are good for us. We're just eating the wrong types, right?
Right.
You know, we've been told in this low-fat, high-carb environment that we've created, where, like, the Entenmann's, you know, cakes that used to be around in the 80s, I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were told, you know, eat those, more of those, because they're low-fat, so therefore you can eat it. And it's amazing how much that mentality still exists today in people, because we've been brainwashed for, like, 30 years with this mentality. I just ran into my next-door neighbor at the grocery store the other day, and she said, "Well, I have to buy this low-fat cheese." I said, "Please don't. Please go buy the full-fat version." Because, you know, it's just amazing. These belief systems are ingrained in nutrition lore for the average consumer. And unfortunately, it's just been so detrimental to our health. As you mentioned, all the refined carbohydrate foods, I mean, bagels and crackers and all of those types of carbohydrate foods in combination with these refined vegetable oils, I think, are probably that and the sugar-sweetened beverages are probably the three worst food substances that I would take out of the American diet. And I think if we did just that, I think a lot of these kind of conditions would improve.
Right, right. So there are a couple important concepts, I think, that you really highlight. One is better understanding of good nutrition, but also your other experience, which is really powerful, is this kind of integrative, holistic approach. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in integrative, say, nutrition and medicine, and how you met Andrew Weil and your experiences in that integrative world that he had first introduced, when in the late 70s, early 80s?
For me, it was around probably the early 90s that I really started following a lot of his work. But yeah, I think he just had he was the person that really pushed nutritional medicine onto the world and said, no, everybody, we need to look at how we're nourishing ourselves, because this is what's going to cure, you know, most of the diseases we have in this country. I think he was sort of the first one to do that. And of course, being a nutrition science major, I was all ears to that. But, you know, he then, you know, he explored a lot of different avenues, and he looked at, you know, he steered away from demonizing, you know, macronutrients. Like he wasn't saying all fats are bad. He gave light to the fact that, you know, we can't demonize any macronutrient. We got to really look at how it's metabolized in the body and therefore make judgments after we truly understand what happens after it's digested. So he just had a very different outlook on how we approach healing, and food was such a huge part of that. I was all in. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of how I got into the whole integrative world. And of course, you know, in integrative medicine, you sort of lay the plate on the table and say, well, what are all my options to help, you know, cure a person with a chronic illness? And it's nutrition is a huge component of that, but it's also things like exercise and, you know, how you manage your stress and how well your sleep is and how you manage your environmental toxin exposure. So I think there's a lot of things on the table that, in combination with those things, it's extraordinarily powerful.
Yeah. You know, and for me, the link is nutrition has such a powerful impact on affecting the underlying mechanisms of health, and that if you don't have the right nutrition, those underlying systems are going to, over time at least, become dysfunctional that then lead to the development, progression, and even acceleration of chronic health issues. And so that holistic approach becomes really a key insight, and the person who kind of gets how to connect both has an advantage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, you know, all these experiences and the insights, and what are some of the basic improvements in practices and habits that you're advocating for and about?
I first, of course, talk a little about just about the basics of food and you know, a little bit of what we just mentioned, which is, you know, getting rid of the refined carbohydrate foods, really just eating whole foods. And it, you know, it sounds very simple, and it really should be very simple, but there's so much confusion now about what to eat. And I think we're, you know, I constantly get asked, you know, what is the best diet? You know, should I eat keto, or should I eat vegan, or should I eat paleo? And I just think we spend so much time arguing about which diet is superior and what foods to eliminate in our diet, that we just lose sight of the end goal, which is really our own personal health and how each and every one of us responds very differently to food. And we should all really be exploring how nourishment makes us feel and how it connects us to a well-functioning metabolism and a thriving gut health. So I think that's really how I start addressing each person's individual health, because I think when someone asks me, what is the optimal human diet, I say to them, well, there isn't one. There isn't an optimal human diet, because, you know, even though all human beings have a lot in common, we're also very different in many, many ways. You know, we have different genes. We have different gene expression. We have different health status and activity levels and behavior. And we have different gut microbiomes. And I think all of these things influence how we process both macronutrients and micronutrients. So, you know, for example, people that have lactose intolerance, let's say, for example, there's about a third of or two-thirds of the population that's lactose intolerant. But then there's another third that has lactose persistence, and they actually have this genetic adaptation where it allows them to digest lactose, which is the sugar in milk. And so there'd be two very different dietary recommendations for each of those people. Or another example would be, like, Japanese people, for example, they've been found that they have gut bacteria that produce specific enzymes that help them break down seaweed, for example. And that may be very difficult for you or I, but for that population, that might be a great food for them. Or someone that has like a genetic disorder, for example, someone that has, let's say, like hemochromatosis, that they store lots of aggressive iron storage in their bodies. I wouldn't necessarily prescribe for them, eat a lot of organ meats and, you know, shellfish, because, you know, I'm not going to, my point in telling you all this is that there's a lot of different scenarios, and we have a lot of different gene expression and different gut bacteria, and there's very different perspectives we have to take for each person. So there isn't an optimal diet out there for every single person, because we have to take all these things into account. I mean, even saturated fat, I think we have had large, well-controlled studies now that have found that, you know, on average, higher intakes of saturated fat are just not associated with higher risk of heart disease, which has been driven into our heads for years. But it's also true that there's a small percentage of the population that they're hyperabsorbers of saturated fat, and that's going to lead to, you know, significant increases in LDL particle size and number. And so for those people, I'm not going to say, yeah, go eat saturated fat. That's fine. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there's just a lot of differences among people. Now, there are general nutrition principles, I think, that we can apply to everyone. And there are general foods that humans are designed to eat. And those foods are, you know, even if we look at, you know, ancestral human populations and we compare all those, the diets that they ate in the past, there's some similarities there. We know that most of these populations ate both plants and animals, and most of them ate raw, whole fruits and vegetables. Most of them ate some form of meat on the bone, and, you know, meat's been a part of, or animal products have been part of a natural human diet for millions of years. So I think when I sit down with a patient or a client or anyone in front of me and when they want to hear about diet, I always say to them, you know, there are four things that I focus on in a good, healthy diet for a human, and that is what you're eating nutrient dense, and is it anti-inflammatory? Does your diet support a healthy microbiome? And does the diet, you know, or the foods that you're choosing support a healthy hormone balance? And I think if you're addressing those four things, I think you're on the right track.
So what about your approach on let's just call it personalization of nutrition, or personalized medicine, that whole concept? Would you take these optimal practices and then combine them with the individual's, I guess, responsivity to what really would work best for them?
Yeah.
How much do you individualize your approach?
I individualize a lot. I think, as I said, I will take a lot of these things into account, and you know, you move forward from there. But I take, you know, I collect a full history on everybody that I see, and we go through, you know, diet in detail. But I think there's a big disconnect with how food, there's a big disconnect on how food makes us feel and how food affects our health. And I think people don't realize, and they often forget, you know, I have a, you know, let's say they eat lunch and then 2 hours later they get a headache or they get GI distress. And they don't link the two together. I think they often think, "Oh, I have a headache because my kids are screaming, or I was stressed out at work today." But they're not thinking back to what they ate at lunch 2 hours ago, and it was, you know, potentially the MSG in their Chinese food, or the gluten in their pizza, or whatever. They don't make those connections. So I think a lot of my time is trying to, you know, siphon out for people, you know, what foods are best for them personally. And given their genetic background, given their history, go from there with these basic four principles in mind.
Yeah. We're here with Nicole Magrida, clinical nutritionist and author of the new book, Nourish Your Tribe. Thanks very much for your time, and we look forward to our next discussion.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me, John. It was a lot of fun today.
Great. Thanks.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and family. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we're talking about being the you that nature intended.